July 11th, 2008, session of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to session. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, everyone from the audience, particularly those who will be appearing before us today to share information. Our first session is setting the stage, filling the skilled worker pipeline. Norm Eater is going to lead the discussion on that. Norm's a good friend of this committee and has helped us try and determine what we need to be doing as a state in terms of workforce development. Norm, we're very fortunate to have you here today. Thank you for the added effort of avoiding that big traffic rush on I-5. Welcome.
Thank you. You've raised the bar pretty high. Chairman Wick, members of the committee, my name is Norm Eater, and I'm executive director of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. The coalition is composed of investors, and I want to make note I use that word carefully, who banded together now more than 4 years ago to give our state's manufacturing sector a voice in how the state mobilizes the resources of institutions and industries to produce skilled and work-ready workforce and applied innovation that gives manufacturing based in this nice sound that gives the manufacturers based in this state added opportunity and advantage as they compete with the world. I think one of the accomplishments of the coalition is that in the last 4 years, I think we've all become very aware that manufacturing is far from dead in Oregon. Manufacturing is alive and well, and it's alive and well because the companies who are making things and paying living wages to their employees in the state are competing on a world stage. They exist, they've survived, and they're enormously competitive and doing quite well even in the existing economy. I want to thank you, Chairman Witt, for your invitation today on this bright summer day to come down, the opportunity to speak about workforce issues. Workforce is a critical problem in the state. We all know about it. We've had lots of time in the last several years to identify workforce and identify the problems. We have several months coming where we can talk about building an agenda. And if I may, what I'd like to do today is use my short amount of time to propose some guidelines and, if you will, rules of the road for the coming workforce discussion as opposed to the past discussion that we've had. First, I want to congratulate the committee. This committee last session was the venue for really the most complete airing of the workforce challenges faced by Oregon as well as the nation. And I know that I've said this to Representative Witt, Chairman Witt, before, but I have referred personally probably hundreds of people to the state's website to view those roughly 6 weeks of hearings that this committee held at the beginning of last session. They were just an extraordinary definition of the range and scope and depth and importance of the problem of workforce. But that was last session. And so the coming session, we need to move beyond the discussion of the problem, and we need to move to solutions. And so in that spirit, let me propose 12 rules. Perhaps as the chairman of Manufacturing 21 joked with me yesterday, this might be defined as a 12-step workforce program for the committee and the state. But I think they capture, And I believe that the participants in Manufacturing 21 believe that they capture a way of thinking about building an agenda for the state for the coming session. So let me just dive into them, and I'll run through them quickly, and then we can have all the conversation you like. Rule number one, please stop talking about the problem. We all know what it is. We know what it is in great detail. You yourselves have identified it. Let's commit that we're not going to have any more hearings about problems, but hearings about solutions as we begin the 2009 session, and acting upon those solutions. Rule number two, let's define the problem we want to solve. Workforce, I'm not sure what what article of speech workforce really is, an adjective, a verb, a noun. It's more a topic. It's a large topic. We need to decide what problems we want to solve. And let me be clear from the views of the coalition. The workforce discussion is not about the scope and quality of K-12 education or the availability of funding for our colleges and universities or the availability of apprenticeship programs. All of those are really good things. They're, however, not the topic we ought to be speaking about when we talk about workforce. So let me be clear, at least, about what we think the issue is. And the most significant workforce challenge is how to get thousands of underskilled, underemployed Oregonians, especially youth, who need and want well-paying jobs, to the front doors of the companies who have the shortages of who have shortages today and will have for the foreseeable future of employees with the skills they need. What that does is that defines the problem as a pipeline problem, and we'll have opportunities to talk about that. Rule three, focus your attention on filling this training pipeline and doing the things that we know will work and maybe even some experimentation of things we're not quite sure of. But there's lots of initiatives, lots of things we can do to fill that pipeline. If we do not do this, if we do not aim at filling the skilled workforce pipeline, which is empty, as you all know from your own testimony, nothing else matters. We can have all the programs, we can have all the initiatives we like, but if there is nobody there to participate in training and to take the jobs that are available, nothing else matters. Rule number five, let me add too that increasing the flow through the pipeline is going to take patience. This is a generational issue, and there is no single global solution. There's not one magic bullet. There's not one thing that will solve the problem. It's a very complicated issue, and ultimately we're dealing with human beings, and in many cases we're dealing with youth. Five, identify a small handful of things that the state can do over the next few years to drive increased flow through the training pipeline towards high-demand, well-paying, skilled jobs. We've identified what those jobs are as a state. There's lots of work going on. There's been new studies during the interiming that have identified those jobs and those skills. We need to match strategies with the demand. Number six, define the key indicators of success and track metrics with data that we already collect. One of the ta-da moments for me when we began thinking about this after the last session about targeting pipeline is that we already collect data that tells us about flow through the pipeline. Think of yourselves as engineers for the moment. The basics of flow through a pipeline are things like enrollment, completions of key programs, wage rates upon completion, job placements, employer and employee satisfaction. We collect that data. We collect it in a distributed way, but the community colleges in your districts, the universities around the state, the training programs, public and private, all collect that data. That's a terrific metric for figuring out whether or not the things we do in the next biennium increase flow, and we ought to be using it. Rule number seven, insist that every proposal, including the ones I'll bring before you, every agency workforce policy package is connected to the problem you want to solve and the state says is a priority. There are, as we all know, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of proposals that are going to come before the legislature. Just an essential element ought to be to say, well, this is our problem. You need to be connected to it and show us how. And that's a very important consideration. And it's easy during a session, frankly, to get off track, to have solutions that sound like they're really cool things to do, but then step back and say, but what problem does it solve? And that, I think, is an essential ingredient of any development of any workforce strategy. Rule eight, new is not necessarily better. New is very likely to produce a lot of new complexity and more complexity that produces confusion and organizational and institutional infighting that, frankly, we don't need. We are blessed in this state with committed people and institutions across the board in public and private entities who are doing training and education and struggling mightily to meet the workforce needs of this state. Give them direction, set expectations, and arm them with the tools that they need, and they'll perform. rule number six. Nine, excuse me, I'm turning them upside down here. Make use of all of the state's resources to fill the pipeline, public and private. This problem doesn't belong to just one organization, to one agency, to one institution. It belongs to everybody. And we need to develop develop initiatives that mobilize all of our resources. And that, by the way, includes business as well. Business and labor need to be at this table and need to be there, need to be here in force. But at the end of the day, we need to allow local innovation. It's very important that we all know how diverse the state is, and there's lots of workforce innovation going around in the state, and we ought to be encouraging that. But at the end of the day, business leaders and the public, frankly, don't really care who does the job. They just want the job done, and that's an important thing to keep in mind because institutions and organizations tend to struggle for dominance. It just is a natural state of things, and the public doesn't really care. It's the job that counts. It's the outcome that counts. Rule 10, take the first steps in 2009 toward a more cohesive and less disjointed workforce training system that reflects statewide needs, local priorities, and the kind of accountability that we need. And we'll have a lot more to say about this as you do your work. Rule 11, challenge business and labor to make workforce a real priority. The fact of the matter is that business and labor say workforce is a high priority, and when they arrive at this table, they say it's a really high priority, but let me tell you about the thing that I care about today. And at the end of the session, workforce ends up, everyone cared about it, and nothing happened. And that's where we ended up last session. So challenge every business person who comes before you who says workforce is important, every labor representative, every citizen who testifies it's important, challenge them to make it their number one priority so that we do something in 2009. And then finally, never forget that delivering more and better trained employees to Oregon companies is not a biennial piece of work, but it's a generational piece of work. Start now. Start in 2009, but let your colleagues know that, and the public, that one session doesn't do it. We will be at this for a long, long time. And the citizens of Oregon and the companies of Oregon and our economy deserves that degree of attention. So thank you today for having me here. Manufacturing 21 looks forward to working with you not only during the rest of the interim, but into the next session.
Orb, thank you so very, very much, not only for the information, but also for the challenge. And I can tell you that it will be our intent to rise to that challenge to the best of our ability. And we will look forward to your assistance in meeting that challenge. Questions or comments from our committee?
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after we knowing this third-point program, which has written out real good. So do you have any special the proposal to address those issues?
Yes.
Okay.
Chairman Witt, Vice Chair Lim, we've been, Manufacturing 21 Coalition has been working since the end of the last session. We began roughly a year ago in August after the close of the last session developing a short list of action items that we'll be happy to bring before you at the appropriate time, as well as that fit this bill, that as well as an idea for long-term cohesion of the system. We recognize that, and let me stipulate, we recognize that there are lots of good ideas out there. You'll have lots of them before you. Ours might not be the best. We think they're pretty good, but they might not be the best. What we would urge you to do is to have a short list, is to recognize you can only do so much. This is back to the theme of a global solution is very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve. We have to view this as a step-by-step effort. Do a few things that can demonstrate some results over the next biennium. Look to a longer-term improvement of alignment of our workforce, of the way in which we organize and identify our workforce priorities, and you will have accomplished a lot in the next session.
Okay, just one comment,
please.
And thank you very much for the information. And it seems to me there is no shortage of lawyers. but we have a shortage of engineers, you know, skilled workers. I don't know, somehow, as a legislator, we need to track, make sure that enough that the pipelines for the skilled workers, if you want to advance into the economic development.
And I think, Vice Chair Lynn, that's a critically important component of filling this pipeline is to know, as Norm pointed out, what first of all what our needs are, to define the problem and then move accordingly. And I think that's just what you're saying. Also, piggybacking, I think off of your question, it would be my intent closer to the session to ask you and Vice Chair Riley to sit down with me so that we can plan out our agenda and when it may be appropriate to have Norm and others come forward with their proposals.
Okay, so Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Norm, if you have the proposals ready, whenever, I'd like to get a copy of it so we can look at it and so we familiarize of that issue.
I'd be more than happy to provide that.
Thank you.
And they do very good work, too. Further questions or comments? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation. As you know, last session we did go through a whole litany of issues and proposals, and one of the things we did identify was basically trying to bolster our programs takes revenue, and one of the frustrating parts of that whole series was we had many programs that were predicated on increasing revenue through the corporate minimum tax, for example, and some others which didn't come to fruition. So is Manufacturing 21 Coalition going to be ready to support increasing revenue to these programs?
Chair Witt and Representative Holby, the coalition didn't take a position on that, and we don't have a position at the moment. And I appreciate your asking for a direct answer, and I frankly don't have one at the moment. The coalition has identified has a narrow base of issues that it works on, and I appreciate funding is at the core. And what we will bring before you is a mix of ideas that will demand increased funding and some won't. And we've looked carefully at a balance between those. Some are simply are organizational. Some are identifying, making priorities for this issue in existing funding.
Thank you for the answer.
You're welcome.
I think in part Norm's answer was is that there would be some members of his coalition that would be ready, willing, and able to probably go in a direction, Representative Holby, that you're interested in. I don't want to speak for Mr. Eder, but I think that's what he was telling us.
Thank you.
Other comments? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Norm, you said something to the effect when you started that manufacturing was alive and well in Oregon. Where are we as far as manufacturing jobs over the last several years and looking into the next couple of years? Have we lost any manufacturing jobs? Have we increased? What are we looking at for the future?
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, the issue of number of jobs is in some ways the wrong question because it's very clear across the country. Oregon, however, has had less of this than manufacturing jobs. The number of jobs have been lost. What has happened in Oregon with regards to manufacturing is that our manufacturing companies have become aggressive global competitors and have upgraded the skills and requirements for their workforces. And so in general, although not, again, it's company by company, situation by situation, there's a lot of diversity across the manufacturing front. But in general, what we have seen in Oregon, and I can demonstrate this with U.S. Department of Labor statistics, has been tremendous increases in productivity. And the job loss has largely been at the lower end of the skill level. So we have this peculiar anomaly, which I tried to point out, and it's peculiar and I think challenging in the manufacturing sector, which is about, I think, 13% or 14% of our total jobs in the state, and in the neighborhood of about 20% of the family wage jobs provided by the whole state. So that gives you an idea of its importance. Is that we have companies that have shed the low skill jobs, and at the same time have tremendous worker shortages at the skilled level due to retirements, upgrading technology, and that's where the disconnect is. The disconnect, as I pointed out in a rule now that I can't remember which number it was, that we have this extraordinary disconnect between thousands of Oregonians who are underemployed and underskilled, and the companies I represent and the other companies in the manufacturing sector can't hire them. Yet they, at the same time, have and will continue to face severe shortages of skilled workers at all levels. And so the issue is less number of jobs than type of job and the wage rates that they pay.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Norm, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, we appreciate your commentary, the first part of which was absolutely riveting. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Before we go on to the next testimony, I'd like to introduce one person, if I may.
Please, by all means.
Okay. Sang-won Koo, can you stand up? Okay, he's a good-looking young man from Korea, and he's studying in the United States for the last 5 years at the, how do you pronounce that, Rosemary Hall? Okay, he's in senior, and he wants to go to the Columbia next year. And he wants to major political science and international relations. He has been interning in my office the last 3 weeks. Today is the last day.
Oh,
so
my
he's
goodness.
Going to Korea, back to Korea, sometime this Saturday. Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Is it Koo?
Sang-won, yes, Koo.
Welcome. And you have the best mentor in the entire legislature.
Thank you.
Welcome. All right. With that, we're going to shift our focus now to qualified rehabilitation facilities and the advisory council. Therefore, just by way of background, this committee in the 2007 session heard two bills related to QRFs. Those bills brought forward by some who had an interest as either employers or employees, and I think were feeling that they were disadvantaged by the definitions of disabled, which the products of disabled individuals operate under in this state, and therefore had first tried to change the definition of disabled to more evenly balance the interests of the disabled as well as those who would be competitively employed, and also to change the makeup of the advisory council by adding additional business and labor interests. Those bills did not make it out of this legislative process, but the advisory council took up a number of those issues and has been working on those issues to try and resolve, again, the concerns of both labor and business. And today's hearing, we're going to hopefully receive updates on the progress in that regard. Our first witness is Jan Dean, Administrator for DAS.
Good afternoon. I'm going to to wait till you have copies in
okay.
front of you.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to talk to you today about the Qualified Rehabilitation Facility Program and the work of the Council. For the record, I'm Jan Dean. I'm the Administrator for the State Services Division at the Department of Administrative Services. My presentation begins on slide 2. This program was established by the 1977 legislature to provide the opportunity for productive employment for individuals with disabilities. Its goal is to enhance their independence and reduce their dependence on social supports. It was also intended to assure a marketplace for the goods and services produced by the community rehabilitation programs. If their needs can be met, and let me know if you can't hear me as soon as... If their needs can be met, state agencies, local governments, school districts, and other tax-supported political bodies are required to use the services and products of the QRF. Turning to slide 3, according to the statutes, a Qualified Rehabilitation Facility, or QRF, is a nonprofit agency that exists to serve individuals with disabilities through employment opportunities. They must comply with all state and federal occupational health and safety standards at the workplace, and they must employ individuals with disabilities for at least 75% of the work associated with the direct labor. That includes preparation, packing, and processing. The hours that are associated with supervision, administration, inspection, and shipping are not included in this count. Statutorily, DAS is responsible to review the price of the products that are manufactured and the services that are provided to determine if the costs recovered are reasonable compared to the market. We are also responsible for drafting administrative rules for this program, and staff also assess if the QRF has a good business plan that will allow them to be successful. Administratively, DAS reviews QRF applications. Administratively, DAS reviews QRF applications. We guide public agencies, QRFs, and businesses in interpreting program rules. We determine suitability, including the facility's readiness for work with regards to equipment, knowledge, if there's a sufficient number of people with disabilities to do the work, their ability to meet the contract specifications, and a quality assurance program or plan. We also review and approve the QRF worksheet for cost recovery, trying to keep the cost within market range for similar services. And we facilitate relationships when the competitive process hasn't provided a contractor or when there are performance issues. Turning to slide 6. In the past, only representatives of the QRFs were on the advisory council, and the meetings provided a forum for discussion on general performance concerns, questions or approaches, rule interpretation, DAS resources needed to support the program, and DAS staff program status reports. In November 2007, we formed the expanded council, hoping to facilitate a better understanding among the stakeholders, identify areas of concern and possible solutions, and to build consensus where possible. The expanded council now has 28 members, and you do have a copy in the back of my presentation of who is on that council. 2 are from business, 5 are from labor unions, 6 are advocates for people with disabilities, 3 are local government representatives, 7 are QRF representatives, and 5 are members from state agencies who use the services of the QRFs. Turning to slide 7, we've held 6 meetings that have included overviews of the program and administrative rules. We've created operating principles, drafted and adopted a charter, identified the areas of concern to work on, and formed a couple of subgroups to work on issues. Frankly, although council members of the subcommittees have worked hard, this strategy has not worked as well as I would have liked to bring issues, the pros and cons of possible challenges or recommendations forward for full council consideration. Because of this, at our last meeting, we agreed to take a break for the summer, have agency staff prepare issue papers for members of the subgroups to review, capture their comments, and bring these forward to our meeting in September. On slide 8, the issues that generate the most disagreement are the definition of who should be considered as disabled in order to participate in this program. This is one of the areas that is being researched this summer, and rather than change the definition of individual with disability, we are looking at the documentation we require for program participation. As an example, the Veterans Administration does have a designation that determines someone is 100% non-employable, and the Department of Education does issue a modified diploma program. Currently, we do not look at either of these certificates or documentation when we consider eligibility. Other areas of concern are how should the 75% direct labor standard be determined. Currently, we look across the organization. Some people believe we should be looking contract by contract. What criteria should be used to determine if an organization is qualified as a QRF and if their products or services are suitable is an issue. And then should we look at the impact on the private sector businesses when a contract is authorized? Over the next couple of months, staff will be developing issue statements, options, and recommendations, and working with their subgroups and council members to get opinions and feedback. We'll go to the council in September for feedback on initial QRF application verification, audit criteria, individual eligibility for program participation as a disabled individual, suitability determination, how long should we post the notice, where should the notice be posted, et cetera. And we will also be looking at some housekeeping issues in our rule rewrite. I've attached a copy of the membership roster for the council and a copy of our charter. My contact information is listed on slide 10, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Committee members. Vice Chair Lim.
The Chair. Yes. Jan, thank you very much. I'm just curious to know what percentage of the people are considered disabled out of the total population, and what percentage are of those disabled actually are hired?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that is not a number I have with me today. We could try to identify that and get it back to you, but when you're talking about the whole population, that is not a number I have, and maybe one of our other guests today would be able to answer that.
Okay, so if you could provide some information, I do appreciate it. Just to determine, you know, that how many are disabled and actually what percentage of the people actually hired and are working.
Okay.
Further questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Jan, could you tell me how many FTE DAS has dedicated to the oversight of the PDIL?
We have, Mr. Chair, we have two staff full-time that are dedicated to this program. Obviously, some management time is also spent interacting with the program, but two staff who service the needs of this program.
And are either of those people auditors or qualified to determine disability?
Mr. Chair, no.
Could you tell me how many contracts there are with the state of Oregon under the PDIL?
I'm going to look back and see if we have. Do we have that number?
I don't have that number.
We will get that number for you. I apologize for not having.
Could you tell me how many QRFs there are? I have 43. And presumably most of those QRFs would have more than one and probably a number of contracts. I'm seeing an affirmative nod in the back.
Then I would say, Mr. Chair, yes.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. And pardon me if I'm asking, you know, questions that are too specific. I'm more than happy to have other people here join you as well. How many disabled clients are served under these contracts? I'm recalling, I think, from the 2007 session that it was in the neighborhood of 5,000, I think, was the number that we were. And I'm not clear myself. I'm going on memory here.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking Tim Crawl might be, or even Darvin, can you?
Well, we have just over 6,000.
You're going to hate me for this, I know.
Sure, why don't you, please.
And identify yourself for the record. It's a very friendly group.
I'm Darvin Pierce. Hi, Darvin. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm a QRF coordinator.
Okay.
And we have within QRFs over 6,000 individuals with disabilities who receive products or receive services through this program.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'm remembering from the 2007 session that the dollar value of the contracts here are in excess of $50 million.
That in that neighborhood, correct.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, that's a number across all public bodies, not just the state.
Not just the state. Okay, so that includes other government entities as well.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
And, Mr. Chair, I would point out that we have published an annual report that has all of the data. We published it on our website,
okay. And
it has quite a bit of statistical information like you're asking about.
Okay, thank you very much.
Could we have Patrick send that link to that website to us?
Okay.
Good suggestion. Thank you, Vice Chair Riley. Now, under this process, who determines disability? In other words, which individuals are not competitively employable? Who makes that determination?
You're actually a better expert than I am, so please feel free.
Mr. Chair, the administrative rules stipulate how a person with disability is determined to be a participant in the program. There are several ways that determination can be made. In most ways, it is done by how that individual comes to the program, by a referral from the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation, seniors and people with disabilities, also with the Department of Human Services. There's also referrals from the Commission for the Blind. And so there's various ways. There's also one additional means by which they can get that referral or become participant, and that is through a physician's written notification that individual is a person with a disability. So, and quite a number are able to participate in that way. So.
I see. Representative Huffman.
Sorry, just a point of clarification. Maybe I got lost on one of the trails. But so on some of these referrals, the trying to redefine individuals with disabilities or the definition of disabilities, what's the problem? Is there a concern that some of the referrals are not disabled or not qualified for the program? Or And I apologize because I wasn't here in 07, so I probably missed some of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, as I understand the concern, I think there is disagreement about which disabilities should be considered. This is not the Americans with Disability Act. Those are disabilities that could be accommodated in a workplace, and individuals that qualify for this program are not. They need additional support to be successful in a workplace environment. And so people have disagreement over how severe potentially a disability should be, which disability should be included. You know, those become the issues.
Representative Huffman, Chairman Witt, what I would add to that really is that it is a matter of severity most significantly, and it isn't very frequently the type of disability can be argued, but more likely the severity of each disability type. So if a person with disabilities has a disability, that's acknowledged by a doctor, a question of whether that individual has a disability severe enough that would keep them being able to participate in the competitive workforce, really is kind of the crux of the matter. So, does that make sense?
Please.
Has there been a problem? Do we see or perceive a problem where these entities are employing maybe less than disabled individuals to work on these projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I am not aware of any instances where that has been the case. There are audits that are conducted, and paperwork is in review to be sure that the files do support the percentage, that 75% number that I used earlier. I am not aware of any compliance issues.
There's no bona fide compliance, or I mean nothing that's been documented. There are suspicion of compliance issues, but nothing's ever been proven per se. I imagine there'll be people talking later who may contend that to be not true. They may say there are issues in how that's been done, but there's nothing I'm aware of that it's been documented issue. So.
Representative Huffman, I think your question goes to the very specific point that probably some folks who will be appearing later will be most concerned about, and specifically folks from the private sector, both business and labor. Further questions? Yes, Vice Chair Lynn.
One more question. There has been a contentious issue last session. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. I don't know whether you can answer that question or not. I understand we have currently 6,000 employees under this QRSQRF program. And I'd like to know the trend at this time. Stay the number as it is, or is it continuing to grow or decrease, and where we are. So at least I can determine and situations of that issue.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we will try to see if I know we have trend data.
Yeah, the trend data is actually located in that annual report I alluded to earlier.
Okay.
And it can show you that there has been an increase in the number of people with disabilities that are affected by this program over time. I think the most recent number was actually a slight decrease over the year or the year before. So.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Pierce, you indicated a minute ago that there were a number of potential different entities that could certify an individual or individuals as disabled under this act. Do they all certify based on PDIL standards, or do they certify on the basis of rehabilitation standards or a different level of government standards?
Chairman, what they all have a way that they clarify how they certify people with disabilities. And there's a consistency among them, but I would say that each of them has definitions according to their own program's requirements.
And that leads me to a point that it has the appearance to me, and it did through a number of the hearings in the 2007 session, that consistency or the lack thereof may be driving some problems. And the problem may be nothing more than one of perception. It may be something that actually is a problem. I'm not ready to make that determination. But it seems to me that it would perhaps make sense if we had some kind of uniform verification form that DAS had, that each entity that did the certification process could certify to, and then vouch that this is the standards upon which they made that determination. And I'm just wondering if that's anything that your advisory council has taken up at this point.
Mr. Chair, we have not taken that up, but I understand it is something we are beginning to talk about in-house and it would go forward to the council.
There is a fair amount of work that's being done in talking to the various agencies that we rely upon for that certification process. And as a result of that research, we are developing some ideas about what the kinds of certification that could be considered automatic, the kinds of certification that may require ongoing verification that that person's disability still does affect their employability. It is really, it depends on, again, the agency that's providing that certification, though. And but we are in the process of learning how each of those work and hope to apply those in a way that does provide an assurance that the person with disabilities meets the definition that is supplied by the statute and the rule.
I, for one, would just encourage to the greatest extent possible uniformity in this process. I just think it would help immensely. I know when I asked earlier about whether you had any staff that were auditors, and you said no, I'm presuming then that DAS doesn't do audits on the 75%.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We contract for that.
And could you explain to me that contract process? In other words, how do we assure the state of Oregon and the taxpayers that 75% is being met?
Well, I'm going to give the brief overview, and then Darvin's going to tell you what's probably. Mr. Chair, as I understand it, we do contract with private auditors. I'm looking at him to see if he starts to react to it, who are skilled in going in and reviewing, you know, employers' paperwork for consistency. They have a list, as I understand it, of what they will be looking for. So the kinds of pieces of information that should be in the file, and it is a when you just do a partial check, not random, isn't, but you know they don't obviously go in through the entirety, but they do a sampling of the files to come to their conclusion.
Yeah, the only correction or addition I'd make to what Jan was saying is that the actual QRFs hire the auditors as part of their fiscal audit. And we don't actually hire them ourselves, but they do have guidelines that we have published. And as a result of those published guidelines, the auditor goes through the QRF's records on a sampling basis to assure that they're being given that all of the records for that organization can be assumed based upon that audit to be meeting the requirements of the rules and of the statute.
All right, thank you. I'm also interested, and I think, Jan, you suggested at least that your work is not completed yet on the definition. And I'm just wondering what your committee has found in terms of the definition that we began with in 1977 and the definition that we have here today. Can you give us some kind of insight to where the committee or the advisory council is and how that gap may be closed, and maybe you aren't there yet either.
Mr. Chair, as Vice Chair Lim, I think it was mentioned, this is an extremely contentious issue. Mm-hmm. And we are not, in my opinion, close to resolution on some of the key and more hotly debated issues. My hope over the summer is that we will be able to propose as staff. One of the things I felt, I'm used as a administrator to potentially seeing policy papers that would fairly briefly, one or two pages, outline an issue, give me some background, some options, some pros and cons that I can ask questions from. And we need to move as a council, I think, although the subcommittees were doing good work. The individual report outs were, a lot of them were verbal. There was strong disagreement. So instead of a document that captured that strong disagreement, that We could then move from as a larger group. I felt our debates were maybe not as fruitful as they could be. So we're hoping to bring a little more structure in, some documents that we can work off of, and I would not want to hazard exactly where that will lead us.
All right, thank you. In addition to that difficult definition, I'm also wondering if you've dealt with definitions of some other words that appear to have posed problems for a number of folks. The term participate fully, which a number would argue opens the door for folks who are something less than severely disabled to participate in the program. Have you addressed that definition yet?
Mr. Chair, we have not, other than identifying that there are some terms like this that we need to address. I think, and again, Darvin, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. My memory of the subcommittee's work is that we did have a lot of work of a subgroup done around definitions. They went out, they got the definitions a number of other bodies use, counties, I want to say mental health, you know, so, but as far as being able to then bring that back in and say, is there something here we can come together on, it was contentious enough and so broad that instead we backed away from that and decided to go to some of these other issues to try to get some agreement, consensus options and come back to that as we had some successes, frankly, and maybe some better understanding. So would you, did I remember that correctly?
Yeah, I think you did. And the only thing I might add was an initial piece of the participating advisory council was to develop a list of issues that they could all agree that we needed to address. I want to believe there were like 43 issues mm-hmm. that were surfaced in that discussion, and each of those were grouped according to how they seemed to be put together, and those various issues were what we then began to use subgroups to discuss and try to develop some resolution. As of your question about the definition of persons with disabilities who may participate in this program, we began to kind of decide we couldn't ever get to a consensus about that issue specifically, so we started to talk about participation. How is a person able to be deemed eligible to participate in the program, which is in essence another way of approaching that same question. So as a result of that discussion, we began to go down the road of determining how various agencies determine what a person is, how a person is disabled that may participate in their program. And so, you know, as I said earlier, that work is still in the process, and we're working towards coming to some resolution. Your question just recently, though, you were talking about participate fully. I don't remember the question of that specifically being addressed, but it is being addressed in kind of as a result of the other work that we're mm-hmm. doing, I believe. So,
okay. All right. The same, I suspect, may be true of the term competitive employment. And the reason I bring that up because I, for one, have a great deal of difficulty believing that there's a difference between somebody's certification based on 39 hours a week versus 40 hours a week. I don't think that 39 versus 40 describes severely disabled. It's someone who works 40 hours a week is any different, perhaps, than the person who's only able to work 39 hours a week, but may, in fact, because they are not competitively employed, be able to be certified or not. And I'm wondering, have you dealt with that term as well?
Mr. Chair, I had not heard the 39 versus 40 hours distinction as far as being competitively employed, and I'm not sure of the history.
Right.
And it has not been a topic at the council at this point.
All right.
No, not specifically that item, no. But I believe the larger issue of how a person's abilities affect their possible participation in a competitive workforce or the competitive employment situation. I think that our discussions about how eligibility is determined begins to work towards confronting those issues. And I think your 39 versus 40 hour analogy might be in that same group.
Okay. Very good. And just quickly here to speed things up, a couple of other terms that come up that have posed problems, disadvantaged and barriers to employment as well. So if you would take a look at those, and if your advisory council could keep us apprised of what kind of progress, if any, you're able to make in that realm, we would be most appreciative.
Mr. Chair, we will definitely look into this and keep you informed.
All right. And then to Vice Chair Lim.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Please.
Concerning the subgroups, could you refresh our mind who they are and then how is it balanced? And then because the balance of the people representing is very important to me. And so if you could give us some information, who are the subgroups representing what groups, and I'd appreciate it, if you know.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we made a great effort to keep the subgroups. I don't have the names in front of me, although others, Darvin might be able to tell you who they are, but we did definitely strive for membership representation without leaning towards one way, a larger group. And so what we ultimately came to was asking that no more than one representative of a group be on each subcommittee so that there would be one voice, even though those voices might not always speak in unison, but still one voice with a general feeling towards the issue on each of the subgroups. So do you know off the top of your head who's on each group subgroup?
I don't know the answer to who is specifically on each subgroup. However, we did try to have a stakeholder or person from each stakeholder group, so a representative from unions, a representative from business, a representative
from
the
PRFs,
right on around.
So, Mr. Chair, my concern is that the disabled group, the smaller than the other groups. I want to make sure their voices are heard and it's a balanced opinion on the group.
Thank you.
And is that the case, that the disabled group has a minority representation?
Are you talking, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, are you talking about advocates versus the quality rehab facility representatives?
I'm not necessarily talking about the minority groups. I'm talking about as a generally disabled group, are smaller than the unions, any others, you know.
You have to look at that.
Sorry.
So you're saying overall for the council?
Exactly. For council or subgroups?
In general, we had six advocates for people with disabilities on the council as a whole, five from labor, two from business. Not all subgroups, people weren't able to participate in all. We asked for volunteers. Not all groups, I think, were represented on every subgroup, as I recall.
I think we actually did achieve pretty broad representation eventually.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Lim. Lastly, I want to ask about pricing. And who sets the prices for the goods or services, and how is that accomplished?
I can take a stab at it all, although Dorabram will tell you how I'm... Actually, why don't you save us all time and go ahead and...
Well, as Jan pointed out in her presentation, we are required to provide the price determination for each contract that's let under the QRF program. The means that's accomplished is the QRF determines their costs for providing the product or service as is required by the agency. They negotiate with the various agencies to assure that those costs and that price is something the agency can live with, and as a result of that process, we get involved, the Department of Administrative Services gets involved to evaluate the price to assure that the costs of the QRF are being covered and that the price falls in somewhere in the range of market. So as a result of being in the range of market, that price is not excessive to the public agency. So, and then as a result of that determination, we are able to allow the contract to be let to a QRF.
So I'm trying to decipher what specific role DAFS takes in making that determination.
Well, Mr. Chair, we evaluate the price that the QRF and the agency have agreed to, okay, to determine that that price is in what is the marketplace for those kinds of services or products.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, we do not have set criteria to say it must be within a 10% range, as an example.
I understand. And that has, there's been a question of whether it is DAS's obligation to do that or not. And I asked a series of questions of legislative counsel a good many weeks ago. I don't know how many to be certain, but it's over a month. And I finally received the answer this morning. My intent by no means is to blindside anyone. I don't operate that way. We did receive the answers here this morning. And our counsel, which I understand is not your counsel, but our counsel has advised us, Patrick, if you'd pass those out,
sure,
that is actually a DAS obligation and role, and a necessary precondition to determining suitability. So I will be interested. This is only a preliminary decision and is, in fact, preliminary from our counsel. But I would be interested as that opinion is finalized, if your advisory council would take that issue up as well and let us know if it is, in fact, DAS's intent to do price determinations.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take a look at that and bring it to the council.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Yeah, please, that would be fine.
Further questions or comments from the committee? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both so very, very
thank
much.
You.
Appreciate your time and my apologies for all the questions.
We appreciate your interest.
You were very patient. Next up we have Tim Krull. Pardon me if I mispronounce it, Bob Jundeff. And Marcy Ingledew, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome. Please decide among yourselves in which order you would prefer to proceed.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Tim Krull.
I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. I've been working in this field since January of 1975 when my wife and I took a job in a group home in Portland. Our association represents nonprofits around the state who serve people with disabilities with jobs and homes. The Columbia Gorge Center, for example, Willamette Valley Rehabilitation Center, many organizations in the Eugene, Washington County area, Portland area. Our association in 1977 requested that then-Representative Dave Frohnmayer introduce this bill, House Bill 3093, that was unanimously approved and has since become the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. It was modeled after a federal program. There are now approximately 40 states that have laws somewhat similar to Oregon's. It's one of our best public policy initiatives for providing employment for people with disabilities. It requires no public funds in the sense of supports from DHS or Voc Rehab. It simply requires that the public agency contract, if a suitable qualified rehabilitation facility is available, with them to provide the work. As you've heard, there's over 43 of these qualified rehabilitation facilities around the state, doing approximately $45 million worth of business on approximately 500 individual contracts. DASH did a study of the benefit, not only to the individuals in terms of their self-worth, but an economic benefit. As people earn wages, their dependence on public supports goes down. They pay withholding taxes. Their study said that for every dollar in wages, there was a $1.15 reduction in public supports to those individuals. And studies around the country and our own studies have shown that and more. Also, the law has served as a primary gateway for employment for people with disabilities to transfer to becoming state employees, because one of the large contracts that several qualified rehab facilities have is delivering temporary services to state agencies. Often what prevents people from disabilities with getting competitive employment is the presumptions that people make they can't do the job. These people are qualified, they have disabilities, they have long histories of unemployment, but as they fulfill their duties in state agencies next to state employees, some of those prejudices go away, and in fact, many of them have been hired and become state employees. You raised a number of issues, Representative Lim. The percentage of people with disabilities in the general population, Marcy can probably address the percentage of people with mental retardation and developmental disabilities, 3%? More like 6? Okay. The last stuff I saw was approximately 3%. It may be more. People with mental illness are probably more than 5%. Studies I've seen say the general population for all disabilities can be in the neighborhood of 10%. It depends on your definition, again, of disability. Is that a disability that prevents you from being competitively employable, et cetera? In any case, there are a lot of people with disabilities in our society, and this law helps more of them become employed in Oregon than any other public policy. So we're very proud of it. You also asked about the trend, Representative Lynn. Frankly, the growth has stagnated in this program over the last several years as the attacks from a small sector of business and more recently one labor union have increased, as we have seen administrative rules become more burdensome, have seen energy diverted from the state agency staff to defending and auditing. We have actually seen, as Darvin said, growth went down this year, and in fact, growth over the last several years has been less than general inflation. It's been a pretty stagnant period. We think as Oregon closes its state institutions, Fairview is closed for people with developmental disabilities, Eastern, the last remaining institution, will be closed fairly shortly. People are moving out of the state hospital. All of those people need a place to live and something to do. We think rather than looking for ways to curtail this program, in actuality, there should be ways to expand it. In fact, less than 1% of public purchases are done by qualified rehabilitation facilities. So the private sector is doing over 99% of those purchases. Some states, New Jersey, for example, recently passed a law that modified their law like ours and set a target of 3% of public purchases to be in a program like this. I know there's a national campaign for what they call a 1% solution, which is to target 1%. That would be a growth in Oregon if we actually got 1%. And the number of people with disabilities who are unemployed who want to be employed has stagnated as well. In studies repeated year after year after year, over two-thirds of people with qualifying disabilities who want to be employed are unemployed, further reinforcing, we think, the need for a program like this. What's the problem? Representative Huffman asked. From our perspective, there is not one. And in fact, there has been no evidence that there is one. There have been allegations, there have been suspicions, there have been charges leveled, but there have not been hard evidence presented that a problem exists. Certainly when we talk about jobs, it's contentious. If a labor union loses jobs to privatization, it's very contentious. The private sector loses a segment of its work to an area where it's not open to public or to competitive bid, that's a concern to them. We recognize that. But we don't think baseless allegations without facts are a way to go after improvements in the system. And in the 10 years that charges have been leveled against this program, we have seen 100% audits of the four largest organizations, every individual who was employed under the program. Problems weren't found. DAS has increased its administrative rules from 3 pages to 26 pages. That's a really burdensome amount. It is the most regulated rule, bunch of rules governing a law like ours in the country. It's more regulated than the federal program. You asked about audit guidelines. There are 4 pages of audit guidelines in the administrative rules, and those are coupled with a number of pages of guidelines for the auditors. So, as Darvin said, when a QRF has its annual audit, they present those to their auditors. Those are independent CPA firms. They have nothing to do with us. They use auditing standards to ascertain 75% participation in direct labor hours, to ascertain that the definition of disability is accurately recorded, that the people who are employed under the program meet those definitions. It's an extremely rigorous process, and it's expensive. From our perspective, since we can pass on costs to the public agency, that is a cost we pass on in the price of contracts. That's one of when opponents to this law first started raising concerns, we couldn't prove. DAS didn't have the manpower to audit. We didn't provide that audit. But in court cases and legal challenges, DAS responded, and legislative challenges, DAS responded with a huge amount of specificity in their administrative rules. Now we can prove, and we prove it annually, that an independent CPA firm says, yep, we attest that you meet these standards. Other questions that were raised? What's been the, Chair Witt, you raised the question about what's happened to the definition of disabilities as originally introduced in 1977? Not a word of it has changed. The law is still the law. The only changes in that law have been, I would say, housekeeping. Marcy would say proactive advocacy. The use of the term was originally handicapped. That became disabled individual. That later has become individuals with disabilities, as we have moved to recognize people not for their handicap, but as individuals first, or not for their disability. Those are the only changes in the law. The definition has not changed, and neither has the interpretation. The courts do not find this definition confusing. In fact, they have, in challenges to the law and to the rules, the courts have said this is a definition that is a reasonable definition. It makes sense to us. The rules that the Department of Administration uses to determine if a person has a disability that qualifies under this law makes sense. So when we participate on the advisory council, and Jan Dean gave you the charter, our association, by the way, which represents the QRS, made the motion to the council that it expand last May to include labor and business and advocates in response to the concerns that were being raised in the legislative session. We recognize that these voices aren't heard and addressed, if their issues aren't addressed, that there's still the potential out there for legislation that could damage the law. The charter, however, is not, and the law is not, to make sure the interests of business are dealt with. Neither is it to make sure the interests of labor are addressed. The law is to increase employment for people with disabilities who qualify. And the charter says that it's to identify priorities, guiding principles, standards, and recommendations to improve the program, including ways to create greater efficacy and effectiveness to strengthen the program. We believe that's what the council should do. It will never be a consensus council. We didn't ever expect it would when we asked that opponents to the program be put on the council. But we thought their voices should be heard and their concerns discussed. That is happening. That will continue to happen. A major concern we have is that a proposal has been given to the council to change the definition of disability. The council has no authority to do that. That's in law. That's your job. You set the law in 1977. You've upheld it against approximately 10 years of various proposals to change it, and you've elected to keep it the same. But the proposal that was put forth by a member of the council would restrict the definition of disabilities to only those eligible for receiving SSI or SSDI, Supplemental Security Income and Supplemental Security Disability Income. That's probably the highest standard in the land. What that says is we, the people, will pay you for the rest of your life because you have demonstrated you cannot achieve substantial gainful activity, not competitive employment, not anything else. You can't earn over $700 a month for the rest of your life. That would push, that's a very clear standard, but it's very, very stringent. That would push over half of the people currently employed under the program with qualifying disabilities out of the program, many of whom have disabilities like mental illness, where because of the cyclical nature of the disability, they can earn money sometimes, and they do, but they don't hold jobs for long. One of the moving testimonies last session was an individual who said, I can get a job. I do get jobs. In fact, I got 27 of them last year. That's not the kind of support that individual needs. So as you're considering how the council is working and what could make it better, we would ask that you look at those facts. Another thing that you'll hear later from SEIU is a number of the people over 400 employed by this program are union members. The labor is not unified in its opposition or in its position at all on this law. OSEA, the Oregon School Employees Association, who helped introduce or requested that Chair Witt introduce the bill's last session, when I asked Ed Edwards at the council meeting last month or the month before, how many people in OSCA used to have jobs that are now being done by a qualified rehab facility, he said one unit. Well, I don't know what a unit is. The unit was less than 10 people. So we have a union that appears to have been very incidentally affected by this law, supporting changes that would put thousands of people with disabilities out of work. We don't think that's proportionate. Attached to the testimony is a recently adopted SEIU International Convention Resolution 11980 that supports good union jobs for people with disabilities. And it goes on to talk about how SEIU will work in partnerships with other groups to develop initiatives and policy that support the employment of people with disabilities in good union jobs with access to benefits. I'm not going to purport that most of the jobs under this law are union, but a significant number of them are, and the vast majority of those individuals are also not just the union members, but the whole population of people served earning more than Oregon's minimum wage. So, we will continue to work on the council. We will continue in open discussion with people who support the law and people who oppose it. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it today. And I'm open for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Who's next? Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff, and I'm here to report that I'm now the director of Disability Rights Oregon. You might notice in my written testimony that I identify myself as being from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and that's because the Oregon Advocacy Center is the former name of Disability Rights Oregon, and we've just changed over. So I haven't got my template on my testimony up to date, but I'm working on it. Again, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what brings me here and what my role is. I'll try to do it briefly. Is that Disability Rights Oregon is primarily a federally funded organization that advocates for the rights of people with disabilities, and those are all disabilities. Over the years, we have grown in terms of the number of federal advocacy programs that we administer. We started out just assisting people with developmental disabilities. Now we assist a wide range of people with disabilities. And in recent years, a number of these programs have been specifically targeted to employment of people with disabilities, to the point that now about a quarter of the federal money that we receive is specifically targeted to assist people with disabilities in obtaining and retaining employment in the community. Now, why is that? Well, it's simply because as we have evolved in terms of the services for this group of people, we've come to recognize that employment is an absolute key to success for people with disabilities. In fact, I would say that in terms of what makes a successful life, people with disabilities are just like anybody else. Having a job, having gainful employment, having the satisfaction of contributing to your own support and being productive is extremely important. Secondly, from a social point of view, if a person is earning money, that means that the state isn't paying for them. They're earning their own keep and gaining the satisfaction of doing so. It means that instead of having to be supervised, say, at a group home during the day, that person is out in the community working and being productive for society and for themselves. For a person with mental illness, it used to be the belief that if a person had a major mental illness, that was the end of the story, that was the end of their life, and they'd be institutionalized for the rest of their lives. But now we understand that people can and do recover, and a big piece of recovery is reentering society and being productive in terms of employment. And so this is recognized as a very significant part of our overall social service system and in making lives successful for people and for their families. And that is why our focus and throughout social services, you'll see that focus has shifted toward this end. The programs that we're here to talk about today are something that I've always thought that Oregon should be very proud of. Because the state has made a commitment with true under 1% of its contracted services, but a fair amount of money, as Chair Witt pointed out, that's going to assure that people with disabilities are being employed. My interest here, upon hearing some of the criticisms, is to make sure, just as you've heard concern, that this money is going to the right people, that it's not going to people who could participate in competitive employment successfully. It's going to the people with, quote, severe disabilities for whom it was designed. And that's why I attended the hearings in the 07 session, and that's why I volunteered to be on the advisory group for this program. And so my perspective on that group was to come in and say, well, let's let's hear the criticisms, let's see how it works, because I'm very concerned that this is a good program. We want the program to succeed. In my written testimony, and Representative Lim, I tried to give some of the statistics that you were asking about earlier. There's a number of statistics kind of spread around about the degree of unemployment for people with disabilities. I found a Cornell study that laid out a graph, and I reproduced it here in my testimony. But as you can see, and I won't go over it in detail, but there's a significant number of people with disabilities who are unemployed. There is different ways to look at it in terms of the number of people who have disabilities versus the number who are employed, the number who are in the labor force versus the number who are unemployed. If you look at any of the ways that it's measured, the number of people with disabilities, even the number of those who are actively in the labor pool, unemployment rates are significantly higher for that group. Would that it were that people were able to find employment in the competitive workplace to the same degree that people without disabilities are able. It's just not the case. So the message I bring to you today is just quickly is that how is this program working? Well, I've sat through the committee meetings. I've heard from the various sides. My feeling is that there has been open, honest discussion about them. I believe the staff is very knowledgeable and has provided an enormous amount of information to all of us. I think there have been some things that have been highlighted, and the things that I think that are worthy of being addressed really don't have to go to... At least I haven't seen any evidence that there are people who are being served in this program who shouldn't be served. I haven't seen any evidence that there are QRFs that have been certified as QRFs that shouldn't be QRFs. But what I have seen is that, and it's probably perhaps because of the success of the program, but that there are ways in which I think the program could be more transparent. There could be more information about it so that it can be held more accountable to those who are concerned about it. And perhaps some of the reasons that we have such a difference of opinion about how it actually works has to do with the fact that we could have clearer information that allows us to make a better assessment of it. And I think that that's worthy of our continued study. And I think in order to get there, it doesn't mean everybody has to agree about it, but I do think that we can agree that there can be information that clarifies the performance of the program. Even if it's a lot more than other programs are held to, if that's what we need to do in order to have this program work, I can support that. Recommendation would be to allow this advisory process to continue to work. I think that there will be some recommendations for some changes that come out of that process, and I would urge you to pay close attention to those. I think they might help.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Chair Lim, please.
Small questions. Could you give me the information, the definition of a federally defined disabled and a state defined disabled? Any differences in it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, there are a variety of definitions of the term disability. And they're different in Social Security law, and they're different in all of the different social service sectors that we operate in the Americans with Disabilities Act and a number of different ones. And each definition is really designed to a particular purpose. For example, what the definition of being disabled is in terms of being free from discrimination, illegal discrimination, is different than what the definition of disability is to be eligible for Social Security or to be eligible for this program. And so when you read the particular definition, it is going to it is going to address itself to the purpose of that program or benefit. And so one of the things I've heard today has been talking about the definition for Social Security and whether that applies here. And I would suggest to you that they're talking about two very different things. I'll just give you an example. There are many people who apply for Social Security, SSI, let's just say, or SSDI, and they go through a process that takes about a year, and the majority of them are turned down for that. And then generally they go into an appeal process. That appeal process can take 2 or 3 years. The majority of people who go through the appeal process, the decision is reversed. Okay. So you have a person in that situation, 3 years. There is no support for that person provided by the state. They go 3 years without any supports, and generally they're applying, and they have to, if they want to be successful, not be working, because they're saying they can't work under any circumstances. So the 3 years without work, without the ability to work, with no resources, and that's where they are. Have a state policy that said, well, you know, we're not going to help you be productive during that time, I think would be counterproductive. So that's just an example of how these definitions don't necessarily mix.
Can we use the chair for one more question?
Please.
To Kim. And concerning that the people working on the QRF program, I just want to find out the wage levels of those people working. Are they required of a federal or state minimum wage law, or what are the average wages?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, all organizations, ours included, any disability or non-disability business has to follow wage and hour law. Most of the people employed under this program are earning above Oregon's minimum wage, but there are people with more disabling conditions who are earning less than minimum wage, because the law allows nonprofits who employ, actually it allows businesses that employ people with disabilities that are so great that they can't earn minimum wage, it allows us or any business, you don't have to be nonprofit, to pay them on the basis of productivity. In other words, an individual whose disabilities are so great that they may only work at 50% or 40% of a non-disabled person's productivity, we can employ that person and pay them at a 40 or 50% rate. We have to demonstrate we do it fairly. We have to pay based on what the community pays, and we have to count their hours. It's a fairly rigorous standard. So some of those individuals under this law, and also others employed by rehab facilities, are earning less than minimum wage under that program. The bulk are not, but certainly some are, and we think that's a great thing, because otherwise we would say, we can't employ you at all, we can't afford the loss.
Thank you for the information.
Good afternoon, Chairman Witt.
Good afternoon.
And members of the committee. My name is Marcy Ingledew, and I am a member of the newly expanded QRF Advisory Council. In addition, I'm also the Executive Director for the ARC of Oregon, and we are a grassroots, advocacy-based, nonprofit organization, and we represent individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities and their families, and we've been around since 1954. However, my most important role is a mother of 3 children, one of whom is my 16-year-old son with Down syndrome, and we are currently working through transition in high school and looking forward to competitive employment as he leaves the school system when he's 21. I began my experience with the QRF Advisory Council in November 2007, and after that initial meeting, we have met almost monthly to understand the purpose of this law. And our meetings have been full of the historical information about the successful accomplishments that this law has provided since 1977. We've participated in long meetings, and ever since the expansion of the council, And it's, in my opinion, as someone that's new to that, it's taken that amount of time to really understand the complexities of how this works, the history of it, and who's at the table. And so we continually work on that. And it was, as Jan suggested, it was nice to have the summer off after those many long meetings. As we continue to move forward, as Tim talked about, we are an advocate, and we look forward to the resource that the QRF allows for individuals as a choice. However, as an advocate, we will continue as an organization to participate on the council and advocate, particularly for the outdated and inappropriate language that, of course, is there since this has been around since 1977 in the administrative rule. From our perspective, we would like to assure that this program can help individuals with disabilities gain competitive employment. We would hope to see individuals go into this program, gain the skills they need, and then embark into competitive employment. We also understand that for some individuals, this is going to be a choice and a resource for them, and we respect that opinion and know that based on the choices that they have in our state and throughout the nation, that this is something that has been very beneficial for them. We'd also like to see private business step up and work with us to help so that we could support them and what they would need to provide competitive employment for individuals with disabilities, not just through the QRF. The Arc of Oregon has very high standards and very large dreams for our community and our population, and so as times have changed over the years, we're very fortunate and very proud of the work that we've done. It's taken a long time to get to the places we need to be, and not everything is always perfect. However, just the resources that are there have been very important to those individuals, and we look forward to continually to work with the council to advise DAS to learn what kind of information we can provide to them, since they have some hard decisions to make in implementing these revisions to the rule. And so we look forward to continuing that work and to moving forward with this program. I appreciate that you gave me the time to speak before you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Questions or comments?
For any one of our, if you would, hold on just a sec. Because actually I have just a couple, I think. Tim, you talked about the audits of direct labor hours, and I'm just wondering if any of the CPAs that do those audits are certified disability experts or certified in terms of rating disability?
It would be, Chair Witt, it would be awfully unusual if they were. I would doubt if any of them are. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just wondering then how they audit the 75% factor.
Well, the 75% is direct labor hours. The mm-hmm. I suppose the step prior to that is, are they really people with disabilities? So, mm-hmm. Look at the administrative rules. It says who can certify. What are the? And they go to the file, mm-hmm. and they're sampling and say, okay, John Doe has this condition. He has been certified to meet the requirements of the Products of Disabled Individuals Law mm-hmm. by such and such. It's uh-huh. there. It's documented. It's in the file. I mean, that's the standard that's used for most things. Very few people can do all of those things themselves, so they look to see that someone certified has done that and that it exists in the file. Did that answer your question?
It does, and I think that it points up a difference, I think, in terms of what I envision is a performance audit versus checking the documentation that has been submitted by someone else. So it may just be a difference of perception. I'm not sure. And then you talked about the good portion of jobs that are union jobs under within some of the QRFs, and I'm glad to hear that. Would those union members all be folks who would be certified as disabled?
Chair, would they all be? Probably not.
Well, a good portion of those.
Oh, sure.
60-80%.
Yeah, that the work done under there's one, actually, qualified rehab facility, Portland Rehabilitation Center. That one, however, does 40%+ of the overall state's work under this law, and they are their custodial work is unionized, so by SEIU Local 49, as you'll hear. So yes, those large contracts all have to meet the 75%. So most of the union employees would be people with disabilities.
Okay, and those particular people would be employees of, do you know who their actual employer is?
Yeah, they would be employees of the Portland Rehabilitation Center.
Okay.
All of the individuals all of the individuals under that work under this law have to
would
be employees
QRF.
Of the qualified rehab facility. Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Anyone else? Not seeing anything. Thank you so very much. Appreciate your testimony. And you're coming on a Friday afternoon. Let's see here. Our next panel is Anna Roberts, Jan Lemke, and Roberta Watson. Good afternoon to each of you. Welcome. Please decide among yourselves who's going to go in what order.
Thank you, Representative Witt. We discussed just really quickly that I would go first. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anna Roberts. I'm an organizer with the Service Employees International Union, Local 49, and I'm here representing the Service Employees International Union. SEIU Local 49 represents over 7,000 property service and health care workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Approximately 400 of our members work for Portland Rehabilitation Center, which is a certified QRF, as Tim mentioned. I'm the union representative for these workers and work with them on a daily basis. For the past several months, our PHC members have been working hard to win a new union contract, and I'm happy to be able to announce that we settled the contract last week, where PHC workers won fair wage increases and affordable health care for their children. We'd also like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the elected officials who stood with the janitors in this process. Very much appreciate that. And I would also like to recognize the Department of Administrative Services for their excellent facilitation of the QRF Advisory Council over the past year. It's certainly not an easy group to facilitate, and it's been very impressive. SEIU accepted the invitation to be a part of this council because we're interested in facilitating, improving, and expanding the opportunities of disabled workers to participate in the workforce. And we're especially concerned that disabled workers have jobs that provide them a voice, protection from abuse and intimidation, and fair wages and health care benefits. We believe, and we joined the committee with the belief that the intent of the Advisory Council was to improve the services provided through DAS in the QRF program and make sure that this program is meeting its commitments to disabled workers in our community. I would like to say just shortly here, I think the QRF Advisory Council has been a very interesting forum for people with a very wide variety of perspectives about the set-aside laws. I think the sort of the process of sort of improving the services, and advising to improve those services has been held up a little bit by sort of general debate about whether or not QRFs are a good thing. I would like to state that SEIU does not believe that our government should be part of the erosion of good jobs that pay fair wages and benefits, and that the contracting out of public services almost always has this devastating effect on middle and working class Oregonians. At the same time, we believe that the QRF program has become a scapegoat in this process, and that this is unwarranted and unfair. Our union represents, we're the smaller of two SEIU unions, but I was assigned to this by Leslie Frayne, who's the the larger of these two unions, SEIU unions, operating in Oregon. We represent 17 contractors, janitorial contractors, and 16 of these contractors employ few, if any, people with disabilities. If the QRF program were to be restricted and reduced in the way that some members of the QRF Advisory Council would like to see, these 16 companies would be more than happy to fill positions that are being contracted out by the government, which would mean that a lot of people who can't get jobs with those companies would become unemployed again and are not competitively employable. And I would mention that if one of those 16 didn't take it, then a non-union janitorial contractor would, which would even further erode the workplace standards that we strive for. And so I don't think that any sort of restriction on the QRF program really speaks to the sort of larger program of contracting out that we believe that the government should not be involved in. I just wanted to make a few comments based on sort of the discussion that's happened before I came here. I think one thing is sort of this idea that the QRFs are somehow employing people that aren't really disabled. That has not at all been my experience, and I think from a worker perspective, there's a lot of stigma associated with working for a qualified rehabilitation facility. You're employed for a company that publicly employs people with very severe disabilities. So it's not like, people come there sort of looking to be employed who aren't severely disabled. I think that a sort of a larger issue as well is that there was sort of this spark, I think, when Portland Public Schools contracted out to Portland Habilitation Center, and that was part of what I described as a process of contracting out, eroding good public sector jobs. If that work hadn't gone to Portland Habilitation Center, it would have gone most likely to ABM, which is a commercial janitorial company and the largest commercial janitorial company, probably the only one that would be capable of taking over 300 positions all at once like that. And I think if that had happened, then a lot of the anger that's sort of currently being directed at the QRF program would have been directed at either ABM as a company or commercial janitorial contractors, which I think would be more appropriate. I don't think QRFs don't cause contracting out, and that situation would not have been avoided if PPS if they hadn't existed. And then Representative Witt, I also just wanted to answer to your question about Chairman Witt, individuals with disabilities in the union. They are our members with PHC are disabled, and I think one of the interesting things that you'll see is that there's a sort of a 75% requirement. But Portland Habilitation Center, because they have federal contracts, complies with what's called the JWAD definition, which is the federal definition for people with disabilities. It's named after the Javis Wagner O'Day Act. And so what I've seen there is that most of the percentage of people who aren't classified as disabled are not sort of able-bodied workers that they sort of hired off the street to fill in gaps. For the most part, it's people who, for whatever reason, possibly sort of the cyclical nature of their disability, have in the sort of annual audit that each one of them is subject to see if they're still disabled, has fallen out of the JWAD classification. They're still disabled, absolutely, and still have a real need to have those jobs, and so it's kind of scary for them when they don't get classified, but it's absolutely well above 75% because of that being the largest population of people who sort of aren't disabled in PHC. Yeah. So thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I also handed out the card of our political director, Felisa Hagens, in case people have follow-up questions after this meeting. So.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to do is proceed with your panel, and then we'll ask questions of you jointly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roberta Watson. I'm the Business Services Manager for Oregon State Police. I manage procurement there and was the Designated Procurement Officer for the Oregon Department of Forestry prior to that. I believe that I was asked to sit on the QRF Advisory Council because of those roles, because I am a customer of the QRF program when we are looking for that type of service. And I hope what I can contribute to the QRF Advisory Council is some of the experience that I've gained just being a staff person for the state of Oregon. I also feel very much like a fish out of water. I am very, very new to, even though we have been customers of the QRF program, until I was asked to sit on the advisory council, I had no idea of the depth and breadth of the concerns that folks have about this, around this issue. And one of the things that I'm hoping will happen is that the QRF Advisory Council, as it stands right now, will be allowed to go through the normal kind of growing pains that any new team, new group goes through when we're given such a huge charge. And there are people that have very differing opinions about where we should be going. I think one of the successes of the council has been that while Darvin said at the very beginning that there were 43 major issues that the advisory council identified as things that we needed to discuss and put, hopefully resolve, those have boiled down into about 12 major categories. And one of the first things that we did when we actually actively started working on the issues was we identified subcommittees and assigned one of the 12 major categories to that subcommittee to begin working on it. And because we're all 110% engaged in our own jobs, then this is what we're doing in our spare time too. But we've really have started in a very positive way to start identifying areas where we can agree. Everyone in the room knows where we don't agree. But one of the things that we are doing, and I think with some energy behind it, is we're actively saying these are areas that where we can't agree. And the major area I think that we agree on is what is the role of the advisory council? And it is to help DAS implement the program. So someone may come up after me and say I'm all wet, but... And I also agree that, as said before I came up here, that one of the things that the Advisory Council wants to do is help make the program transparent so that when customers, state agency customers, local government customers, are asked questions about the program, then anyone can take that information and answer it intelligently, so that it is not something that is smoke and mirrors, you know, oh, it's DAS said you had to do it. I think that's something that's important from a state agency perspective, and I think we will get there.
Thank you.
Chairman Witt, members of the council, I'm Jan Lemke. I'm with the Department of Corrections. I'm their designated procurement officer. I've been with them for 2 years, and from day one of my pleasures was to be on the QRF Advisory Council, so I've been a member for the last 2 years. Coming from the Department of Corrections, we are a large user of QRF products, and we also have a facility in Baker City where we are working with Step Forward on the refurbished toner cartridges, so we're partnershipping with them on that. My background also, I was with the state printing office for many, many years, and we were a large user of QRFs. We had people in our facility doing hand bindery, and so I have been working with them for many, many years very successfully. It's a wonderful program. People have been gainfully employed, and it is wonderful to come to work and work with people who just have a zest for life and they enjoy what they're doing, and being able to interact with other people besides in their group homes or wherever they come from. They get out and they're actually taking the bus and coming to work. So that was a wonderful experience. I agree with what Roberta has said about the committee. It is a very important committee. And I do agree that while we've had some bumps along the way, we can get over them. We are all very impassioned, and we all have a strong interest in making the committee be stronger, making the QRF rule be stronger. And so I just want to make sure that I help bring it forward and assist DAS in their day-to-day running of the program.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the procurement folks. You've worked with QRF people for some period of time, mm-hmm. and my main question is, you both say you've had good experience with this. Why didn't we hire these people?
Go ahead.
Vice Chair Riley, Mr. Chair, part of the reason that for the Department of Corrections, some of what they do is they have, we get some uniform items from them or some bedding, and so for me to employ them, it's a little difficult. I already have a captive audience that we need to keep.
Right.
So for me in that respect, it's a little difficult. But when I was working with the state printing, part of the dilemma on that is you didn't have enough work to keep somebody gainfully employed. It was more of a seasonal or a situational. When you got a big project in, you would be able to bring people in to help you on doing hand binder work. So it was more of a situational.
Vice Chair Riley, Mr. Chair, at Forestry and ODOT and Oregon State Police, we're we look at the Qualified Rehabilitation Facility contracts as it is a social program, and we are required to look at them in areas where they are can provide services. So we try to, in those areas where they are providing services, which are primarily, in our case, janitorial services, that's where we work with them predominantly, or have worked with them predominantly in the state agencies I've worked with in the past.
Please. And in the janitorial area, for instance, why you say you're required to look at them where they provide services, but that's only if you're going to contract.
Correct.
My question is, why don't you hire them? Why aren't they state employees?
My Vice Chair Riley, Mr. Chair, we're not able to get the FTE to.
That's what I wanted to hear. Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions or comments? I want to thank you, panelists, members, very much. Appreciate your testimony. And our last scheduled panel will be Jerry Egger, Ed Edwards, David Wiegand, and Ken Cropper. Welcome.
We're going to go down the row.
Good afternoon, Chair,
right.
Members of the committee. My name is Jerry Egger, and I'm the owner of Mid Valley Presort and Mailing in Salem. And I've been trying to figure out this program since 1994, which is when I lost my first contract to the Secretary of State's office, even though I was low bidder. I've spent a considerable amount of time, probably 10 to 15,000 hours of my life, not only in research, but also, unfortunately, in litigation, essentially to try and understand what the definition of disabled means in a law that this legislature drafted in 1977. I've lost the opportunity to bid on millions of dollars worth of contracts, and I've lost probably almost up to 20 contracts, including one the first of last month. Price wasn't an issue. Quality wasn't an issue. It was simply this law being used, in my view, inappropriately, to take my business, my livelihood, and job opportunities from my employees. And in listening to today's testimony, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. But I'm going to start kind of hyperspeed, or at least retro back to 2001, which is after the first few years of my involvement in this program. I was asked by DAS to participate in a Products of Disabled Individuals Law work group, which is not dissimilar to what the Advisory Council has gone through the past 7-8 months. I was really disillusioned at that point with DAS management from the standpoint we were actually working on the definition. And then toward the end of 3 days of facilitated mediation, I was actually asked to contribute money in order for the process to move forward. I was offended and declined. But that didn't solve any of the problems in the PDIL and the ensuing disaster at the Portland Public Schools, where 318 individuals lost their jobs. There is data, there is documentation to show what's happened over the past 31 years regarding this law. I have some of it. I've given it in testimony since 1996. And there's probably over 23 depositions that have been taken since the initiation of my first lawsuit against DAS, asking them for clarification, essentially, on the definition. As it's structured right now, the Advisory Council started really strong. We had a facilitated, well, we essentially had a mediator. We strived for consensus. And I wanted to let every member of the committee know that I've participated to the best of my ability in the sessions and in some group sessions. And I do have several concerns. Number one is the council's not subject to any public meetings laws. It's simply only advisory to DAS. It really doesn't have any power, per se. The membership contains many members that really have conflicts of interest financially related to obtaining contracts and or commissions. And I'm the only small business owner, so I guess I look at this a little bit differently. Obviously, I want to survive, and I do appreciate the law, and I think it was well intended. But not being able to control the agenda or meeting schedule, I think, is a problem. So essentially, it's not independent. I think it's, at this point in time, it's all that we have. And I think Jan Dean has taken on quite a challenge. But I look forward to participating. But there are some fundamental problems that I'm not sure can be overcome. During the 14 years of my research, I am not aware of any full compliance audit that's ever been performed on the program. We've heard today about audits, you know, and I encourage you to ask me any question. I'm not sure that I can answer it, but I'll certainly try. The audit that we're talking about is only about one piece of the law. It's only about work hours of direct labor. And I'd also like to point out that the 75% applies whether or not the products or services are procured under the statute. And that goes down, you know, another trail that I really won't get into today. But essentially, the legislature put in that provision that it applies to all the contracts, not just the public contracts, which means when my nonprofit competitor competes against me in the private sector, you know, I would expect them to use disabled individuals that the legislature intended. I don't believe that's the case in my situation. In terms of suitability determinations that DAS is making, I started this research back in 1996-97. It was not until 2003 that DAS issued its first suitability determination after going from 1.5 pages of rules to over 23. This means that any small business or every small business that lost a contract during that time or union worker member or any individual never had notice. And that's a huge issue with me, and it is being addressed in one of the issues of concern. But compounding that, these suitability determinations are being made at this point, in some cases, regarding categories of products and services. So there's no way to identify the specific product or service, even if an individual company wanted to challenge it. And the DAS website posting doesn't really explain what that notice is. So the only way that an adversely impacted party can find out what's going on is to know exactly where to go and check the website every day, because you only have 14 days to protest. So regarding the price setting, this is also very problematic from my perspective as a small business owner, because my competitor, for example, has multiple divisions. And when I first learned about the law, I thought that this would protect my business from the standpoint of the state would have to establish a price that recovers the costs and they need to use disabled folks. But that all changed, at least superficially, in 1998, even though the legislature in 1977 received a clarification from LC, Legislative Council, that DAS was administering the program on a per-contract basis. They changed that in 1998. So they're administering it on an organizational-wide basis. So there is no per-contract requirement, when in fact it's my understanding that my nonprofit competitor can take a contract from me and not use any disabled folks. So that's a huge problem for a small business that's trying to make a living and get by out there. So those issues I really hope to address, and others, and I will continue to participate in the advisory council. But those are some of my main concerns at this time that I'd like to share. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think I'm going to ask that each of you make your presentation, and then we'll ask questions when your panel is complete.
Okay. In the interest of brevity, I'm going to summarize my testimony.
Please, and if you'd introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Witt and members of the committee, I'm Ken Cropper. I'm the former political organizer for SEIU School Employees Local 140. We represented the Portland Public School custodians that had their jobs outsourced in the summer of 2002. What I'd like to introduce today introduce into the record are the stories of 10 of these custodians. This was actually a testimony that was submitted to the House Business and Labor Committee in April 29, 2005. It was in the middle of their displacement, and these folks were hurting. So please read these stories. They're heartfelt stories. And what I would like you to look at is not only the savings that the Portland Public Schools said that, you know, they were making, but what about the cost of these workers that and their, that lost their jobs? What about the cost of their families? So I'd like you to take a look at these stories, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer your questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ed Edwards. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent approximately 21,000 educational employees throughout the state of Oregon. The work in our K-12 schools, Head Starts, ESDs, libraries, parks and recreation districts, community colleges. And I want to thank the chair and the committee members that have heard our testimony on the QRF issues before, and I want to especially thank for having the interest to have this hearing today to keep updated on the some of the issues and concerns that OSCA has with this law. As most of you know, we got involved in became aware of this law in 2002 when over 300 Portland public school custodians were displaced when the QRF took the contract for custodial services at the Portland Public Schools. And very shortly thereafter, we lost 8 OSEA school custodians in the Rainier School District in the same way. QRF took a contract for custodial services there as well. And what the concern that we bring here is probably that side of the story. Because these folks were displaced from the job not because they were unable to do the work or not professional in the work that they did. They were displaced from their jobs because they weren't disabled. And that's what the PDIL does. So when we talk about the wonderful benefits, as we heard from previous testimony, I would say that each one of those is at the expense of someone else who is not having a wonderful experience. And I echo what Mr. Cropper asked the committee to do, and is to review the stories from the custodians who were displaced. Again, I need to tell the committee that it's not a contracting out issue. We fight contracting out a lot in school districts and community colleges. Most of the time, luckily, we win and keep the jobs as public employees. But at times, we lose. Normally, what happens when we lose is the new contractor comes in. He's won a contract that requires employees. And the first people he hires are the folks that just lost their job with the public employee, because they know the job, they have the experience, and it's a great benefit for the new contractor coming in. When a QRF takes a contract, that option is closed. There is no applying for a job, because there is a 75% direct labor charge within it. These workers go home. And they automatically go on the unemployment line for as long as they can get unemployment. But everybody here knows how long it took for the Portland Public School case to be settled. And during that time, people lost their homes. People lost their cars, their bank accounts. People lost health care, dental. People got sick. And there's a story, I don't know if it's in Ken's document or not, where a person's wife, you know, passed away, and one of the reasons is she couldn't get proper medical care. So I would ask the committee to recognize that side of the coin. I didn't really come here to talk about all the different aspects of the QRF, QRFs and the products of disabled individual law, but rather to talk about the advisory group that was formed and expanded. And I want to begin by thanking Jan Dean, the director of DAS, and her staff for going forward in this area and inviting OSEA to the table, along with some of our partners in this struggle, to try to figure out the products of disabled individual law and how it could be redirected back to where its original intent was, through clarity in the law and through specific language that really tells everybody, not just the QRFs or the disabled, but small business and labor, of who actually qualifies to be in and take part in this program. There is no such thing now. None. And I'm hoping that we can correct that. The expanded advisory group has been very interesting and very dynamic. And in some ways, I'm happy to say, but in other ways, a bit, it's been exhilarating. and passionate. And, you know, and this issue brings out passion in folks. It particularly brings out passion to me. And I'll be the first to admit that I probably raised my voice a few times when I should have been a little bit quieter. But I'd say, in the most part, that everybody on this committee, on the council, has acted very, very well. I'll also say that the divisions or the interests of the parties have been expressed very well by each side in every meeting and in every subgroup. We have met, I don't know how many times, six, seven times, and then subgroups that have been formed over the past 7 months. In May, we had our last meeting. And unfortunately, from my perspective and from OSCA's perspective, it was the worst meeting we had. It was that meeting that we looked, and I think DAS also understood it and saw it clearly, that what is happening in that room was completely counterproductive. And what was happening was nothing. After 7 months, 20 hours of meetings, plus subgroup meetings, plus work that individually we have done, those who sit on the committee, before going to the meetings. And the results of finding even one issue out of 36, and I have the chart with me, it's 36 issues. Not one could the group find consensus. I think there's a reason for that. Because there was an issue that was very, very simple. It was about notice. It was about simply notifying the public, citizens of Oregon, businesses small and large of Oregon, of a suitability determination. There is no notice given today, and there has never been notice. What happens is DAS posts on their website a notice of determination. And if you just happen to be surfing their website one day and go to the QRF and go to the suitability, you might find it. But that notice is up for 14 days, calendar days. Not work days, calendar days. And so people who have an interest, like Mr. Eggers and small businesses across Oregon, labor groups like my own, who might go there once in a while to see whether or not any more of our people are going to be unemployed. But if you don't check that site, you're going to miss it. And if you miss the 14-day period to find it, and also within that 14 days file an objection, then you're out. That goes through without any objection whatsoever. And these objections take time. It takes time to research, analyze, put together, because it's what you submit is going to determine your standing in filing an objection on a determination. And if you do have standing, we have never had standing, by the way, because we're a union, but our workers could get a standing. And if they had standing, then that piece of paper, which is many pages, is then reviewed, and a determination is made whether or not you have merit. So what you submit is extremely important. What took them months or even years to create in a suitability determination, they're giving the public 14 calendar days to respond. So our group, subgroup, took on this issue. Can we figure out a way to provide better notice? OCA's position, why don't we go to 30 days, 30 calendar days. And we also had put out and said that we should probably try to identify adversely impacted parties out there who, if we go through with this suitability and a contract is awarded, somebody out there is going to get hurt. And maybe we need to notify them directly, not just put it on the website. To me, that made a lot of sense. Federal law requires it under JWAD. doesn't require it here. We started out, the conversation went very well, but very shortly, the question was, the answer to our concern was, well, if people really care and think they're going to be negatively impacted, then they should check the website more often. The conversation digressed at that point. And I fell into a comment or comments that I usually end up saying at any of these type of meetings that involve the QRF and the set-aside contracts that take people's jobs away and displace them. That this law is a very, very special law. And when it was passed in 1977, it was passed to serve a very specific group of individuals, the severely handicapped. That's why it was passed. That's who it was to serve. And today, it is serving a much larger population of disabled. And to be quite honest with you, I think the question should be, okay, exactly what kind of disabilities are covered that qualify someone to participate in the QRF program? The actual disability. Show me the list. You can get a list from Social Security of what qualifies on Social Security disability. And in Oregon, by the way, we have been a proponent, for instance, that we could define this very clearly. We don't have to spend a lot of money on definition. We just adopt the SSI, SSDI. Anybody who qualifies for that automatically is qualified to be part of the QRF system. It doesn't cost the state a dime to do it. You can go through a file and actually find something that means something rather than some physician saying that this person has a disability. In the state of Oregon today, and these are figures you can get right on the website from Social Security, there are 100,000 Oregonians throughout the state who are receiving SSI, SSDI. That's 100,000 citizens of the state. Social Security has a program called Ticket for Ride, Ticket to Ride, which waives all kinds of restrictions for those folks to find work. And just think, if this federal government, this Ticket for Ride, teamed up with the QRF, how successful that would be for that population. And rather than trying to find employment for everybody who has a disability from hemorrhoids to hangnails, that we focused on the real intent of this law is providing employment opportunities for those people who are absolutely unemployable. No questions asked. I can live with that. My union can live with that. We have been at this for not as long as Jerry. Only two sessions. And I was very, very hopeful when we began this process. I was very hopeful when Jan Dean got up at the very first meeting and said, everybody's point of view here and opinions needs to be heard. And we must try to reach consensus on finding solutions to some of these problems. But I'll tell the committee this. So far, there has been no consensus because as far as those people who need to listen and recognize that labor and small business and large business have some problems out there and they don't listen and regard those problems as real or something that they should try to address, then there's never going to be consensus. And there's never going to be any give and take. There has not been one issue that has been brought up within the full committee where the qualified rehabilitative facilities and major advocates of disabled have given any credence whatsoever to any of the issues we have raised. I am hopeful beyond hope that somehow Dan Dean and the folks at DAS can somehow absorb all of the things that have been said, because there's been a lot of things said, and somehow go back to their offices and come up with some ideas that we can actually say, wow, that's great. We've been through two sessions, and each session we've made compromises in every position we have held. We have tried our darndest, and we're trying hard now. I am not optimistic about the results here, but I do know that our union, whether we've lost 8 members who got displaced or 1, that one person, that one member that we represent is important to our union. We don't even represent them anymore because they're gone. We still care. And we are committed that that will never, ever happen again. Thank you.
Questions or comments from the committee? Gentlemen, before I ask any other questions, I want you to be considering, because I don't want this right off the top of your head, but I'm going to ask you for what you consider to be some of the solutions to the problems that you brought up here. What would make this situation better? I'm going to give you a little bit of time to think about that as we go through some other questions, because I really want to elicit from you what's going to improve a situation which you have a problem. You brought a problem to the legislature. And I'm sensing that your problem is not perceived as a problem by others. If you had the perfect world and understanding that others have concerns and considerations and interests, not the least of which is the employment of the disabled, which I believe I can speak for every person in this committee. We want our disabled to be employed and productive members of society to the greatest extent possible. And with that consideration on the one hand, how do we address the problems that you have brought to us now on many occasions? And with that, I will ask the committee members again, does anyone have anything further? Because I do have some specific questions. I'm not asking it of any one of you in particular, whoever is perhaps best suited to answer the question. We have heard, I think, at least a couple of times today, that there has never been an instance where we have had documented proof that non-disabled people have been certified under the PDIL. From your vantage point, is that an accurate statement?
Chairwood, I'm going to approach that directly. If you don't look for it, you're not going to find it. In the Portland Public School situation, to my knowledge, there is documented evidence, and I believe if Jan Dean talks to her counsels or attorneys that was involved with that, especially the QRF coordinator that was in charge of actually approving the contract, they'll discover that there's plenty of abuse in that specific situation, not only related to not employing disabled individuals under that contract, but also the fact that there was another QRF that had submitted a bid. The fact that the Portland Public Schools didn't want to pay more money to the other consortium of QRFs, that's a different issue.
I'd like to speak to that issue.
And if you would, just for the record, state your name so that we can the recording can track who's saying what.
For the record, my name is Ken Cropper.
Thank you.
And I know about this issue because I lived it. When the Portland Public School District first said that they wanted to contract out their custodial workforce, we assumed it was going to be a private contractor, you know, that would be the biggest threat to for those people.
But what they found later was that they were putting the contract out in an RFP only to QRFs. And ultimately, it boiled down to two, Portland Rehabilitation Center and Tualatin Valley Workshop, which Tualatin Valley offered to do the work for $14 million a year, and PHC underbid that by a contract of $9.6 million. Initially, they said they would do the work for $12.5 million, but they dropped, and I don't know how this factored into the price determination, but they dropped it to $9.6 million. But at the Portland Public School Board meeting, July 8, 2002, representative from PHC, Debbie Houston, she's the vice president, I believe, of building operations, was asked by Jerry Jackson, school board member, if they were going to hire disabled workers for this contract. And she said, well, not for the foreseeable future, because they didn't have the capacity to do that. They would have to hire several hundred people, and in the meantime, they'd be hiring non-disabled workers. Well, you know, I think this was an abuse, because it took them over a year to get anywhere as close to hiring their 75% direct labor disabled workforce. As a matter of fact, I've got a QRF facility application for July 1st, 2002 to June 30th, 2003, where they were found to be out of compliance with their 75% workforce. And actually, they came in at 64.32% of total direct labor done by disabled workers. What happened is, and I've got a statement here by Patty Beans, who works for DAS. She's on the QRF program there. PHC has been given a cure notice for direct labor requiring quarterly audits. Patty Beans signed on November 26, 2003. So there is, in the records of DAS, a rather large abuse, in my opinion, of a company coming in, taking the jobs of 318 people, and not even hiring the disabled workers that they were supposed to hire. And as a matter of fact, those same workers that were hired starting in the fall of 2002 were themselves displaced. When PHC fired 200 people to get the numbers down for their 75%, and they still came in out of compliance.
No, Ken, I'm maybe I'm just not mentally running as fast as you are.
Oh, yeah.
You said they didn't hire the disabled that they were supposed to.
They said they weren't going to. They said they had a grace period, that they would, for the time being, hire non-disabled workers so they could fill the contract, because they didn't have the capacity at that time. They had to double the size of their workforce. As a matter of fact, in my testimony, there's a flyer that we passed out at the Portland School Fair in January of 2004 that has some quotes from the Oregonian about what happened in that process. I'll quote Debbie Houston. Okay. This is about 200 people being terminated.
Which 200 is this that's
being... These were the people that took the jobs after the Portland custodians lost theirs. So these were the people hired to fill the jobs in the Portland Public Schools with PHC.
Okay. So, and these are qualified disabled or
not? No. They said they had a grace period. And I don't see anywhere in the DAS, in the Products of Disabled Individual Law or in administrative rule where there is a grace period. But this is what they said they were able to do. And 200 people, here's the headline of the flyer, displaced PPS custodians and many of their replacements shared the unemployment lines for the holidays. You know, so I don't think that served either the people that lost their jobs or those people that went to work for PHC in good faith, not knowing that they would ultimately be fired.
Mr. Chair, Ed Edwards. The question that you asked originally, was it concerning the medical records to verify a disability? Was that where you were going?
Well, I had heard in earlier testimony today that there had not been, I'd have to go back through my notes here, no verifiable evidence that people had been inappropriately certified or not certified. And this is, frankly, the scenario that Ken has just laid out is really 180 degrees. It's kind of the flip side of the coin of what I would have anticipated hearing. This is suggesting that there may be an incentive, at least in this instance, to hire people who are, or rather to avoid the certification, and hire non-disabled people. And my presumption would have been that the incentive drives trying to certify people as disabled. So I'm hearing the other side of the coin at this point. Equally disturbing, by the way.
I do believe, this is Ed Edwards, during, I believe it was the last session, we had a lot of discussion about verification of disability in the work group. Each session, 2005 and 2007, the interested parties, the chairs of these committees, brought the interested parties together to try to hammer out, see if there was areas of agreement. One of the things that the disability community brought forward when we were looking for some kind of verification process, have a doctor who actually can say, yes, you have this particular disability, and it makes you unemployable, or whatever the level is. When we put that forward, the disability community basically said, well, that just means more tests, more doctors, more everything for every single disabled person out there. We listened to that, and we had long discussions about trying to determine what would work and be friendly to the disabled, and at the same time set up a system of verification so that the public knows that this law is being used properly. And the set aside, no big contracts, etc., are being utilized efficiently and correctly as well. It was very difficult, and that's why I go to these SSI and SSDI qualifications, because it is a very simple thing to check on. One of the other problems you run into is in trying to verify, like going through records, is you know, people's names on medical forms is very private information. It's not for public consumption, and so it's a limited amount of how to set something up like that. So there is verification. I listened to the testimony given prior about the backlog, and I am sympathetic to that. I think there is an answer to that as well. I mean, there can be, somebody who has actually applied for SSDI is waiting for some sort of determination. We, clearly could set up something in those cases to verify at the state level whether or not this is really a viable case and make a determination while the individual is waiting for determination from the feds. And I think that's something, again, that's doable.
I am I'm left in a position as a legislator where there have been a number of people over several sessions who have brought repeated problems. We had legislation, two pieces of legislation in the 2007 session. That didn't make it through the process. We went through the folks that are parties of interest, decided that they would take those issues to the advisory council. From what I've heard here today, we're now into the seventh or eighth month, and I don't want to take too literally some of the testimony that people presented here. But it has the appearance to me, and some of the committee members may be of a different opinion,
but it has the appearance to me that, based on the testimony at least, the only thing that you've reached consensus on in 7 or 8 months are the items that the council will try and explore. Now, I may be wrong. There may be others that have a difference of opinion. And the way I'm about to characterize this may be a little bit too strong, but it also has the feel to me that the lack of progress and the emotional differences that are in existence led to a timeout. This is not getting to where we need to be. I am also convinced by the testimony that the process needs to be allowed to work. I am convinced that the parties who have an interest will craft the best solution. But 7 or 8 months is testing the legislature. Now, I think we've talked about a number of issues, and I think, as a number of witnesses have already said, that everybody knows where the areas of disagreement lie. I don't think there's anybody in this room that doubts that. I don't doubt it. I don't think any of the panel members that appeared here today doubt that. So after 7 or 8 months, it is my encouragement, my most strenuous encouragement to the Advisory Council, to please try and settle these areas of disagreement over the definition, or several of them, what constitutes the 75%, and to a lesser degree, the pricing, which I'm sure will take care of itself. If we don't see any progress, the legislature is going to be forced to act. That will be, I think, in some people's perception, an imposed solution. I think we need to let the process work with the Advisory Council. I would ask the Advisory Council to get to work, to get to task, and to show some progress. I would also suggest that the first step towards progress is a recognition of what other people perceive to be problems, and a respect for that. Respect for the problem, respect for the parties, and respect for the need for a solution to those problems. I would ask every one of you to go back and attempt to conclude your work, to make some solutions that are acceptable to all. Now, I recognize that that may be a little bit naive, but I certainly think that we can find a definition that works for folks, and I certainly think that we can come to a general understanding of what 75% really means and the degree and the severity of the folks that get an opportunity to participate in the program. I think if we were to ask the general public, the folks that are watching this proceeding today, whether or not, as Ed suggested earlier, that hemorrhoids qualify as a disabling factor, that the 80-plus percent of the people on the street would have questions about that. I also think that if we were to query the average person on the street, we would hear very directly that Oregonians want their disabled to become productive citizens and part of our society. That is your charge. I expect to hear progress the next time you are before our committee, and I wish you all Godspeed and good luck. in that endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
With that, any further questions or comments from this committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Yes, not directly with this issue, but some other issues, such as at this time, and our economy is going down.
Yes.
And then the mortgage building down.
Yes.
And the gas price so high. And unemployment is going up. And we got a problem in our state.
Yes.
I think our committee is charged to discuss this issue.
I agree.
And possibly finding some solutions in the future. Of course, this issue is related to the federal, national, and the local here. But what I'm trying to say, we need to find out some kind of answer from our community, from our state perspective. So hopefully, Mr. Chair, my suggestion, maybe next committee meeting, and do we have any chance to discuss of this issue so we can, how we can weather out of this severe problems facing in our state.
Thank you very, very much, Vice Chair Lim, for bringing that forward. There are a great number of Oregonians, and no different than the rest of our country, that are very severely challenged now in terms of the family finances and the costs of energy, of health care, of a lot of the necessities that that are part and parcel of the everyday family budget. Thank you for bringing that forward. I would only ask that we perhaps defer that past the next meeting because we are, I think Patrick has tentative plans for us to go to Oregon State.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I've spoken to folks at Oregon State University and also at OECDD about setting up a tour of the Wave Energy Center at the Oregon State University, and also getting a briefing from a few other items related to economic development that OECDD and also OSU would like to brief the committee on. With the chairs and the committee's permission, I'd like to submit some correspondence to the members by email maybe Monday, asking them about dates they may be available next month for such field trip.
Would that work for the committee members? Okay, and I can assure you that that will be, I think, a much more enjoyable meeting, perhaps, and much more on a positive note. Vice Chair Lim, I am in no way dismissive of your concerns and your desire for our committee to take a look at some of the things that we might do. And I would suggest that maybe you and I and Vice Chair Riley get together to take a look at some of the things that we might be able to do and begin that planning process. And I would certainly invite the input of the other committee members, although I recognize that you're all very busy people and probably don't want to attend a full-blown planning meeting. But and we have a quorum. That's another consideration, too. So anything further to come before this committee?
So, Mr. Chair, before
yes,
we
please.
Adjourn, so how many committee meetings are we scheduled to have before the end of the year?
If I may check my work plan, I believe we are definitely going to hold at least two more, one of which would be the field trip. And then there would be at least one additional meeting beyond that.
Okay.
I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that we may have asked for three or possibly four. Yeah, we have, our work plan says three or possibly four committee meetings. So to the extent that leadership will grant the committee four meetings, well, we'll conclude.
And if we meet as co-chairs, we would avoid that potential problem. All right. With that, is there anything from any member of the public, anything from a public member who would like to present anything here this morning before we adjourn at 4:20 on a Friday afternoon? Hearing nothing further, we stand adjourned. Thank you.